Hi, my name is Mary Wilson, and I'm interviewing Karen Thompson, pastor of Uprising Austin. It is October 6, 2020. Welcome, Karen.
Hi, Mary.
Good to see you. Very good to see you. So my first question is one that will help us get a little background information. So I was wondering if you could share some stories about yourself that help describe formative times in your life that have eventually led you to be the pastor that you are today.
Yeah. I was raised in the church, in a Lutheran church, ELCA, and that was very important to me. I lived in a very small town. I grew up in Pflugerville when it was very small, and my friends were, we went to school together, we went to church together, all of our lives, our whole lives were intermingled, and so church was a huge part of my life, being part of the youth group. And then that continued when I went off to college and I was involved in Athletes in Action and various types of youth group work, even when I was in college. It was, I taught public school for 16 years before I decided to go to seminary. And when I went to seminary, I entered in the Master of Arts program, prepared to just get a degree in theology for some other work that I was doing. I thought it would be good for my credibility and my some other work that I was doing. During my, and I was a member of Central Presbyterian Church in Austin, Texas. Mm-hmm. And I was, at that time, I was not out. I am a lesbian, and I was not out. I was part of this church, and I was going to seminary to get a Master of Arts degree. And I had experiences in seminary that convinced me that, yes, absolutely, I wanted to be a pastor, felt called to be a pastor. So with the support of Central Pres, I switched from the Master of Arts program to the MDiv program, and for several years moved towards ordination. At that time, the Presbyterian Church was not ordaining out gay people, and we all knew that it was a possibility that my move towards ordination could come to an end, but we just kept working, and eventually, I was approved for ministry in Mission Presbytery, but that was immediately appealed, and there were various hearings and cases on that. And by the time that it got to the highest court, the Permanent Judicial Committee of the Presbyterian Church, I had decided that I had done as much as I could for unity, for opening the way for LGBT people to be ordained. And I made the move to metropolitan community churches. And I was ordained in metropolitan community churches at what was formerly, what was at that time MCC Austin. I was ordained in 2007 and became senior pastor there in 2008. And that's where I still am.
Okay. Would you say any part of that journey was painful?
I would say a lot of it was, but not overwhelmingly so. And definitely the different painful times were worth it, all of it, all of it.
In what ways?
Forms who I am as a pastor. I think, you know, here's how I phrase it. When I was standing before Mission Presbytery being examined for ordination, I used a line from The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. They were talking about Aslan, the lion, and the question was, is he safe? And the answer was, no, of course he's not safe, but he's good. And what I tied that to my experience of ordination that, you know, following your call, following God, is it safe? No, but God is good. And so ultimately that's what came out of it for me. And I believe it made me a more compassionate person. I believe it prepared me for some of the things that we go through as pastors that seminary can't possibly prepare you for. Mm-hmm. So yes, there was pain, there was anguish, there were some dark nights, but ultimately it has been a blessing.
Yeah. Has it helped you with people coming into your congregation who have experienced past pain with church life and even rejection, if that's not too strong of a word?
Yes, definitely. I think so. Metropolitan Community Churches have, they're 50, turned 52 years old today, October 6th.
Yeah.
Turned 52 years old today. We're begun by a defrocked Pentecostal pastor named Troy Perry. And MCC churches have literally saved lives, not just spiritually, but physically saved lives. People hearing for the first time in their entire lives that God loves them, even if they are LGBTQ people. And so many of those churches, as you can imagine, were and continue to be almost triage centers, that terribly wounded people, people who have been cast out of churches, cast out of their families, lost jobs, lost their children. They come to these places, and sometimes the wounding is so deep and the pain is so deep that that there's never an invitation to heal and to grow. It's just we will be your sanctuary. We will be safety for you. We will be your reminder that you are loved and that you are valuable. And one of the things that we are very intent upon at Uprising is inviting people into a wholeness, inviting them to come out in all of the ways that they can, to bring themselves to light, to take spiritual growth very seriously, to begin to heal in all kinds of ways. And I think my experience made me both empathic with that. With that experience, I know how it feels to be cast out of the church. I know how it feels to lose family members and be afraid for a job. And I also know about the freedom that's on the other side.
Yeah.
And I think that's helpful with me. Our congregation's about 90% LGBT.
Right. Right. So I'm going to interject maybe a little bit into our friendship here, because I know you have a tattoo that has the word hope on it. Can you share a little bit about that and what that means to you?
Well, it's not just a hope, but it is rainbow colored.
Yes.
So it's, you know, red, orange, yellow.
It seemed like it fit this part of the conversation, and I was wondering if you might share.
When I was going through, I had started seminary, and I was going through the process, and I was at a bookstore, and they had these bumper stickers, and they were hope in these rainbow colors. And I said, "Oh my God, that's it! That's the first sticker I've ever been willing to put on my vehicle, because I just think it's such a commitment to put a bumper sticker on the car." So I bought not only that one, but I bought all the ones that they had, because I wanted to have one all the rest of my life, and I wanted to be able to give them away, because hope is my thing. And this rainbow hope just said what I needed to say. So on just before I was ordained, I was part of the clergy intensive process. That was the last step before being ordained in MCC. And I took that bumper sticker into a tattoo parlor. I said, I want this. And so it appalled my children. It was
really,
it was 14 years ago now. And it appalled my children, who at that time had no tattoos themselves. And I'm not sure if they do or don't any at this time.
Funny.
But yeah, that's my thing.
Yeah. Well, tell me more about what hope means to you. What does it look like? Do you have a definition that you think of when you think of the word hope?
I think I think of a lot of things. You know, now abide, faith, hope, and love. I think of all that. I think of Christian faith being founded in the hope of the resurrection. It's not the end. We can be transformed to the image of Christ, all of those things. But one of my favorite quotes about hope comes from Jim Wallace, who I think I've got it right. I could have conflated several quotes or whatever, but basically that hope is looking at the evidence and then waiting for the evidence to change. So I don't want it to be a naive hope. I want it to be an informed hope, but I just believe that ultimately love prevails.
Are you drawing upon that recently? These days?
I decided long ago, I was thinking, how should a pastor sign a letter? And I was thinking, all right, sincerely, faithfully, in Christ, all these possibilities. And I settled long ago on always in hope. And that's how I sign things. That's how I sign off on things when I write to our congregation. It's just, for me, that it's never the end of the story.
That certainly is a meaningful way for me to think about our faith as well. There's the end of the story is yet to be written, and the worst day is not the last day. So all right, well, let me move a little bit into the pandemic time and how it is impacting you personally and professionally. And we'll talk more about how it's impacting your congregation, but how is it impacting you just on a personal level first?
I think I don't even really know yet what the whole impact
That's
is.
Fair.
The immediate thing was just, how do you be a pastor without people? How do you be a pastor without people? That's so important to me, is that that life together, that you know, that happens. It happens Sunday to Sunday. It happens Wednesday to Wednesday. It's, we are living life together, and so distressing for me. And I try to be honest with my congregation in all things. And at the beginning, there were many times when I would say during a service, "No, I miss you. I'm not sure what to do or how to do this, but I miss you." And I immediately set up some things like, at first I was doing Zoom calls with me for anybody that was lonely or had questions or just wanted that relationship with the pastors. At 8 o'clock every night except Sunday night, I took Sunday nights off. Mm-hmm. We started to build some community that way. And I have a wonderful group of deacons at our church, and we started talking about different ways that we could reach out to the congregation. And one of the things that's really hard is you don't know who needs what. You don't know who has great needs that you're not hearing from. You don't know how many times you need to reach out until someone really trusts that it's okay to share my pain or my loneliness or my vulnerabilities. It's just that not knowing. I'm a hugger, and I miss that.
Yeah.
I have taken hope from my friends reminding me that that really social distancing is a misnomer. It's physical distancing.
Right.
That we can continue to be socially and spiritually connected. I have a wonderful staff who keeps me encouraged and keeps me supported and is learning new things to make sure that we can make our, we decided not to do recorded worship. We do live worship on Facebook Live. It limits some other, it limits us in some ways, but I think that real-time connection is so important. There hasn't been a day, I don't think there's been a Sunday during this pandemic when I would have felt completely comfortable with my sermon and with the prayers and with other portions of the liturgy if I had recorded it even on Friday.
Right.
Things change so fast.
They do. They change from Friday to Sunday morning. There are certainly times I adapted my sermons on Sunday mornings because of what happened overnight. You know. I know some churches are doing some things that are more pre-recorded and trying to connect then at different times. And I want to go back to one of the words you said about the staff and the deacons about being encouragers. Do you feel like as a minister and as a senior pastor, you are drawing upon that more now than you have at other times? And what I'm trying to get at is the distinctiveness of this time. Is it distinct to this time in the ways that you are using that?
Yes, I've never been afraid to show that I'm human. If I'm physically ill, if I'm emotionally, mentally tired, whatever, I've never been afraid to be open about that. But in this time, I just want to be strong in the ways that I can be strong. I want to be some normalcy for people. I want to be the person they've known me to be that they can count on, that they're going to see me next week and they can expect the same things from me. So in ways I'm leaning on that more. I'm letting and encouraging people to do the things that they need to do for their mental and emotional health, reminding them constantly, and then they in turn remind me that we're in a pandemic. You might feel less productive, or you might be putting things off or changing your priorities, and we sort of remind each other of that it's okay. I've really strengthened my relationship with a few other clergy persons that we just have come to depend on each other so much. We talk at least once a week. And we're sharing both personal and ministry concerns.
I had a thought and now it's gone. Maybe it'll come back. We are getting older. in terms of establishing community, and this actually does kind of go back a ways to talking about how do you be a pastor without people. And in thinking about the way you set up Zoom calls, have you found any Zoom fatigue creeping in at this point? Are you still doing 8 o'clock every night?
No, I went to, I pretty quickly dropped Saturday night because that was really hard before Sunday mornings. And then I dropped Thursday night because, and one of the people that was part of that group picked it up and they started doing a game night on Thursday.
Oh, okay.
And sometimes it's like our deacons meet every month, and our deacons do a lot at the church. And we meet on the first Sunday of the month. This Sunday, the past Sunday, October 4th, we decided not to meet because of literally Zoom fatigue. Nobody needs one more Zoom.
Yeah.
There's nothing I felt like we could offer: devotional, encouragement, sharing time, maybe something fun. There was nothing I felt like we could offer that was more important than a break.
Well, I think that's important to recognize, isn't it? When we need a break, when we need rest, when we need downtime. Is that more difficult for you during this time to recognize when you need breaks and when you're zoomed out?
So what I've noticed is I'm a person who generally has very good work life balance and a person who generally has very good boundaries in place. When I'm at work, I'm working. When I'm at home, I'm homing,
right.
And I have what I've found is that everything seems to bleed into each other. So this could just be my failing, but I don't feel like, I feel like it's a sign of the times. I'll get, say, a text from a congregant or a board member about an item of business after 10 at night.
Yeah.
Or early in the morning, just through, it's just like I'll tell a little story if I have time, if you'd like, about sort of how that happened. So when our last Sunday in-person service was March 15th, and I know that because my third grandchild was born on March 15th, and so I left the service to go to the hospital. Luckily, I got into the hospital. I was like the last visitor period, and then they shut it down. But so we started hearing right away that there were going to be these shelter-in-place orders, that people were going to have to stay at home. And my first thought was, if I have to stay at home, what happens at the church?
Right.
And I thought that stay at home was going to be strictly enforced. I thought that things might have, like, they might check your driver's license to see if you were at the grocery store closest to your house, or that there might be checkpoints on roads to make sure you aren't doing unnecessary travel, all of that. And I said, I cannot be away from the church. We have hungry people to feed. We collect food for the homeless and clothes and all of those things. So I talked with my board, and I literally moved into the church for 3 months. So a big part of it was so that there was someone there to take food deliveries, to get food out to people that needed it, and all of those things. But the other biggest part was I could not accept the church shut down. I could not accept no lights on, parking lot empty, signs on the doors. I couldn't. For me, the church is a lighthouse, is a beacon, and I felt like the lighthouse keeper needed to be there. And it was an amazing time to have both that relationship with our buildings. And the church is not the building. The church is the people, and God's work through the people. But it was a blessed time, almost a sabbatical time. And I found that people would stop by because they heard that the pastor was there, or they saw my truck there, and people not even part of our congregation would say, "What do we do? And are you giving blessings?" And so it was really a blessed time.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing about your vocation, it is hidden from the road by a lot of trees and growth and so on. And there's some security issues there.
Right. Oh, absolutely. It could invite vandalism or whatever. And so I was on call.
Yeah. After I left my position at Church of the Savior at some point this summer. There was a break-in, and it's very open and public and so on. But it goes to the point, people could take advantage knowing that, you know, a physical presence is not the same as it has been. I don't really know any more than that. I don't know if anything was taken or what damage was done. I just kind of heard it through the grapevine, sort of speak, you know, but yeah, so it's an unusual time. And I want to get back to the space idea too, because I'm thinking about like Kathleen Norris and the way she writes about physical location and the spirituality of that. And I certainly experienced that in my church's space. I mean, I loved going out to the sanctuary and just sitting sometimes and enjoying the way the light came in or the banners, and just the space was meaningful to me. And I'm hearing that you were experiencing that as well, that something about the space that was helpful to you.
Can
you elaborate on that any? What is it that you like about that space, or what touched you?
It's all of it. We have 10 acres and it's wooded and beautiful, and our buildings are not traditional brick and mortar. They're sprung structures. I say they're like being in the womb. So they're domed and ribbed.
Yeah.
And each building has a great big skylight in the top. So you have this constant, just this golden light, this warm light. And it's just a, you know, a feeling of being on holy ground.
This seems to match up well with your idea of the church being a beacon as well, being the light out there, the lighthouse, and the way the light comes in there. That's a nice imagery to think about.
Our building is very alive. I know all buildings have their own noises and everything, but this kind of special. I mean, the wind comes up, the whole thing sways, the lights will sway. Rain doesn't sound like raindrops. It sounds like a deluge, you know, but you're just this close to nature, you know. You're inside, you're warm and safe, but you're this close. It was a wonderful time, a quiet time. The quiet was good for me. I didn't have a television that whole time, and I didn't miss it. So prayer, study, reading, it was like part of the rhythm of the day, as opposed to this is the time for this. It was just the rhythm of the whole day.
That's really refreshing to have that kind of sense of time. It reminds me of Heschel's Palace of Time idea that, you know, time can be holy and sacred. Yeah. Well, I actually remembered what I forgot earlier, which was related to the text and messaging, and it's stranger hours than in the past. My sleep has been disrupted in odd ways because the change in rhythm, if you will. And I'm wondering, is that a sign from members of your congregation that theirs has been as well? And then I'm wondering about yours. How are you sleeping?
That's a great question. Well, my whole sleep rhythm changed when I was at the church because I've always been a morning person. But I'm early to bed and early to rise. But when I started staying at the church, I went to sleep later. Part of that was just sort of being on guard. You know, what have I not locked up? What have I not turned off? What do I need to shut down? And there, you know, hearing all those noises, it was not always, you know, comfortable. I'd worry about this or worry about that, and
sleep
on an air mattress, And literally one night I heard something woke me up. I was very lightly sleeping and I heard some noise and it sounded metallic. And I was afraid that somebody was hitting the door, like maybe to destroy the lock or get in.
Yeah.
And I went looking around. So for security, I used a can of wasp spray.
Oh, okay.
And a 7-iron. So I had a in my golf club, a wasp spray. And I couldn't see anything. And this was a Thursday night. And then on Friday, later in the day, when I was around in the back where I had heard the noise, the lock, we had a like a realtor's lock box with an extra key for the building.
Right.
It had been cut off.
Oh, wow.
Been cut off. So I had heard the metallic, and I don't know. And we had all the locks changed. The security cameras, but no, it was not a good 3 months for sleep.
Yeah.
And some other things, but mm-hmm. lately I've been sleeping better, but lately I just think I'm about a month ago now, I made a real clear, I had a real clear 180 of this is all we have. I'm going to stop thinking about it as though we are preparing worship and creating worship and then like we always would and then offering it to the people through video or whatever. This is all we have. I'm going to put the same time and effort and energy into creating the virtual experience as I would put into the in-person experience. It means that our order of service has changed. Mm-hmm. It means that we're trying to, one of the things I started doing is inviting people to send pictures of everything. So when we're doing something like last Sunday was our 45th anniversary. I discovered that the 45th anniversary is the Sapphire anniversary. So we invited everybody to send us pictures of them in their blue. Uh-huh. We also, and this was just, you know, just something symbolic. We've been doing a worship series and the specific topic for last Sunday was communion. And it also was World Communion Sunday.
Right.
I made a big batch of bread and then cut that bread into little cubes, put two in a package, made a few hundred packages. And then we had our people out on Friday morning and Saturday morning for a few hours, handing that bread out.
Oh, wow.
To people so that when we took communion on Sunday morning,
yeah.
we were sharing that one loaf experience. So we're trying to do things like that, that just feel like we're together. We're encouraging the comments on Facebook Live mm-hmm. by either asking specific questions or encouraging the people to interact with one another.
Yeah. Well, I think you're kind of getting at a question I haven't overtly asked, but it's, you know, how is your congregation doing during the pandemic and not meeting yet, trying to figure out ways to be community and that sort of thing. You've described a lot of that between like the way you did communion and some of the Zoom calls on the game night. Is there anything else around that you'd like to add that you haven't already mentioned? Seems like you hit on a lot of things already.
We were going to, one thing is we do small groups. We do them 3 times a year. We do for 8 or so years now, we've done a whole church study in the fall mm-hmm. Where we're all sharing a book or a learning. And then in the spring, we have everything from country dancing to auto mechanics, to Bible study, to, you know, whatever. These small groups, and in the summer we do summer activities. Well, we had decided that we were having our people were having a little bit of fatigue with that, and we were going to take this year off But because of the pandemic, we decided to go ahead and bring back the small groups. So we just started yesterday. We have about 8 groups with anywhere from 10 to 20 people in them.
Yeah.
And so people have, and a couple of them are in person, but they're things like taking care of our campus. And so people will be outside, they'll be socially distanced, they'll be wearing masks. One of the things is for people with addictions, mental illness, it's been so hard, everything exacerbated. Loneliness, which I think has already been an epidemic for a while now, is exacerbated. People who live alone, people who live with maybe roommates that are non-compatible. We've had, people relapsing into addiction. It's been hard, and not being able to make hospital visits is hard.
Yeah.
And not just for us, but when you think about the way that families aren't able to be there for each other, that's tough.
It can be heartbreaking.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
I worry about all the children and what they're experiencing. Now, I do not believe that we should prioritize their socialization over their physical safety. I don't believe that we should just be putting, sending back kids back to school in person because it's better for them to be there. I think we've got to prioritize physical safety and for our people and in South Austin where we are. So many of the school kids are from low socioeconomic homes and they're living with multiple generations, and I want all those kids to be safe, but I worry about them too.
Sure.
Are they learning to be afraid? Are they learning not to trust? Or what's going on in this?
Are they learning not to hug?
Are they learning not to hug and, are they learning not to need hugs or want hugs? Or
yeah, yeah.
I just don't know. I just don't know.
Yeah. Well, no doubt they will have some shaping that is different than, say, what you and I had at the same age or what their parents had at the same age. Well, I want to ask just one more question. Is there anything that has come to your mind as we've been talking that you have wanted to say that somehow we moved past? Anything else that you think is important to share about your personal journey or the life of the church, and especially in connection with the pandemic?
I would say that there have been some incredible challenges. I would like to say that I know so many clergy are struggling right now, and I'm praying for them, and I hope encouraging all the clergy to really reach out to each other. We have this bad habit of talking about numbers and membership and all these things, and it's a time to be real and to reach out to each other when we need to. And many, many, many churches and nonprofits are going to fail financially. And yeah, we need to figure that out and how we support each other through that. There's also, for us, there have been some real opportunities that I'm not sure we would have been open to had it not been for the pandemic. This would be a great story to close with because it's just amazing. We built a new sanctuary that we finished about 3 years ago. And so that means we have our original sanctuary building. And for several years now, we've tried to figure out what do we do with it? How do we use it? And we come up with some big plans and some big ideas. And one of the things that we wanted to do was to create a school, a daycare, a preschool for deaf infants and children. And we feel that's a very underserved population. Mm-hmm. And, we have certified teachers prepared to teach the kids. And we thought, what an amazing way to use our space. So that was a piece of it. Okay, so put that aside. Just a few weeks after we'd started only virtual worship, I received an email from a woman who said, I watched your service online. I've never been to your church, but a friend of mine suggested that I watch the service. So I saw the things that you're doing in the community. And one of the things that really caught my attention was your outreach to the unsheltered population, to the homeless people. Mm-hmm. And I know that you provide food to them and other things. And so she said, I would love to help somehow. So I said, well, sure, let's talk. So she came in, we talked, and this woman owns a daycare. And many of her children are from low socioeconomic homes, and there are government subsidies, including food, that her daycare receives. And all of a sudden, she didn't have her kids in daycare. Mm-hmm. She said, what if I take the food that's coming in anyway, and I prepare it for the homeless, and your people deliver it? Sure. So we set that partnership up, and we went from giving food out one Sunday a month to 6 days a week.
Wow.
So the pandemic actually allowed us to increase that, but it gets better. So her daycare had been in a church for 20 years and the church has closed. The church failed and the buildings have been sold to a developer. So they had to find another home. So we said, I wonder if our building would work. Uh-huh. So we are in the process right now of bringing them in. It is a daycare that serves our neighborhood children. Yeah. Exactly. Wonderful. The kind of relationship we would love to have. And we will be able to bring in our deaf infants. So that it will be a trilingual situation with English and Spanish and American Sign Language. And we'll probably be able to start that earlier than we would have been able to if we were going through the whole licensure process, et cetera. So there have been some tremendous blessings.
That's a fabulous story.
Yeah.
Thank you. All right. Well, I'm going to go ahead and turn off the recording.